We're going to talk about happiness this afternoon. I think I first started thinking about this subject as a possible lecture. Actually, it was before I was even thinking about lecturing, but I thought about the subject when my daughter, I was driving with her, and she was about 9 or 10 years old, and I had seen I'm driving with my daughter, and I had seen a bumper sticker that made me laugh right out loud. And I looked over at her, and she wasn't laughing, and she said to me, "I don't get it." The bumper sticker read, "You have to kiss a lot of frogs before you finally meet a prince." And then I realized at that moment that I had never read to her the fairy tales that had been read to me when I was a little girl. And so I very briefly explained to her the story about the handsome prince who had the spell cast upon him and was turned into an ugly frog. And the only condition under which the spell could be broken is that he receive that first kiss of genuine love. And the witch who cast the spell knew that would never happen because he was such an ugly little creature. But I told her as the story developed, he met a pure and innocent young maiden who in time was able to see beyond that ugly exterior, and she saw his humor and his intellect and his genuine caring. And she did give him that kiss, and instantly he was restored to the fullness of his manhood. She had two comments. The first one was, "That must have been some kiss." The second one was, "And then what happened?" And I said, "Well, nothing. The fairy tale ended, as all fairy tales did, right at that moment, with the phrase, 'And they lived happily ever after.'" She said, "You mean there were more stories like this?" And I said, "Yes, there were a whole series of them, and sometimes it was the female character that had the spell cast upon her. But always, the condition under which the spell would be broken was that wonderful kiss. And every fairy tale ended with that phrase, 'And they lived happily ever after.'" Well, by then, she was off in another direction. It didn't hold her interest very long. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. The more I thought about it, the more I realized how the fairy tale mythology had penetrated, even to today, our cultural expectations regarding happiness. Long after I outgrew fairy tales, I went to those Sunday afternoon double features. I was a teenager, and I loved the musicals. They were so bright and bubbly and happy, and they all had the very same theme. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back. And the music would swell, and they would hug and kiss, and you walked out of there just knowing they were going to live happily ever after. It's in our fiction, it's in our theater, it's in our music. Whether it's the songs that I remember my mother singing in the kitchen when we were doing dishes together, or whether it's the soft music coming from my college daughter's room when she's home today, there's always this same theme. Not too long ago, I heard a golden oldie that my mother used to sing. Many of you have heard it. "You're nobody till somebody loves you." When you think about that, isn't that a terrible thing to say about a man or a woman? That they're literally nobody unless they're in love? Do you know how that song ends? "So go and find somebody to love," like almost any old body will do. Sadly enough, there are some relationships that are built upon that quiet kind of desperation. How we need to re-examine what it is that causes happiness. Because so often, when we have thought that that relationship, or that job, or the promotion, or the new home, or the vacation, or the retirement, we thought these things were going to bring us happiness, it hasn't happened. When we look to persons or circumstances for happiness, there's often that empty feeling because it hasn't brought the fulfillment that we expected. And that's what we're going to be talking about this afternoon. We're going to be looking at some questions. What is happiness, and where is it to be found? Obviously, if you look in the wrong place, you won't find it, but there's a subtlety that we're going to be looking at, and that is, what is it that happens when we continually look in the wrong place and don't find happiness? What's the subtle danger there? And then we're going to be looking at what it is that can enter into a relationship that promises so much happiness and either quietly erode it or abruptly smash it away. We're going to be looking at the teachings from the scriptures, from the writings in Christian Science, and I'm going to be sharing examples from my own experience. And we're going to have some fun, because you can't look at human relations without laughing a little bit. And sometimes if we don't laugh, it cuts so close to the bone that we can hardly bear the discomfort. But it's not going to be a frivolous discussion, because whether or not we find that contentment, that happiness in our lives, it deals directly with our physical well-being. I read in the New England Journal of Medicine a most provoking statement made by a prominent American psychologist, Dr. Michael S. Aronoff. He said, "The majority of people going to outpatient clinics with bodily complaints are really saying, 'My life hurts.'" A false sense of what constitutes happiness can be disastrous in our experience. So while we're going to have a little fun, we're also going to find it to have a very deep purpose in our discussion. And we are going to focus on the male-female relationship, and primarily marriage, but it isn't going to be exclusively in that direction, because the discussion will cross all lines. It will apply to the teenager and the golden ager, the married, the single, the divorced, the widowed. What is happiness? I heard a speaker speaking to a very large audience in a public lecture make these comments about happiness. He suggested, if you wish to be happy for an hour, take a nap. Now, I really hope nobody tries to get happy that way right now. He went on to suggest that if you'd like to be happy for a day, go fishing. If you'd like to be happy for a week, take a cruise. And then he suggested, if you'd like to be happy for a month, get married. In a minute. But isn't that about the time when the honeymoon glow begins to wane and the couple finds themselves faced with the nitty-gritty of merging two separate sets of backgrounds, of cultural practices, traditions, two separate sets of expectations often? They're discovering the need for mutual compromise, learning how to listen with the heart and not just with the ear, learning how to love is even more important than being in love. In way of contrast, I heard another speaker. He was recognized as a leader in his church, as was his wife, as being prominent, and had both of them had dedicated many years to church work and to service in spiritual areas of endeavor. And he was also speaking before a public group, and there was a question and answer period. And everyone who knew this couple felt they had a very good marriage. And one of the questioners, rather facetiously, I think, raised the question, "Does your wife make you happy?" And to their amazement, he answered, "No, she doesn't." And he went on to say, "God makes me happy, and God makes her happy, and together we are very happy." Now that's focusing a little more clearly on what happiness is, but we need to be careful, because we're not talking about a God who somehow sits on a divine throne and arbitrarily dispenses happiness to some and withholds it from others. What he was talking about, he was a Christian Scientist, he was a Christian Science lecturer, and what he was talking about can best be explained by a statement, and I'm reading from the foundational writing in Christian Science, a book entitled Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, written by Mary Baker Eddy. "It is our ignorance of God the divine principle, which produces apparent discord, and the right understanding of him restores harmony. Now, some of you may never have heard God referred to as divine principle. It's not a word used directly in the scriptures, but it's implied all the way through when we read of God as the only primal cause, creator, foundation, law. These are all ways of saying principle. It is our ignorance of God, the divine principle, which produces apparent discord, and the right understanding of him restores harmony. Now, harmony is a larger concept, but it includes happiness. It includes purpose and fulfillment and peace of mind. Let me explain it this way. Suppose someone were to set out to write a little piece of music, and they understood nothing about the principle of harmony as it applies in music. And they selected a series of notes and chords that each in their own right were exquisitely beautiful. And they put them together, ignorant of the need to have an established key and to have an established rhythm pattern and so forth. They could end up with a very, very discordant little piece. And all of the tinkering and rearranging and reworking wouldn't produce harmony. But if someone came along who knew the principle of harmony as it applies in music, put everything in one key, did a little rearranging, maybe established some rhythm, and took out a few things that simply didn't work, you could end up with a very pleasant little piece. It would be the ignorance that produced the apparent discord and the right understanding that would produce or restore the harmony. And so it is with life. When we ignorantly try to find happiness by looking in the wrong places, all of the tinkering, the readjustment, and oh, we find it so much in our culture today. When happiness isn't there, people start thinking of changing their hairstyle or their partner or their lifestyle, taking off inches, putting on inches, relocating, anything to tinker with the human situation, and they still haven't found happiness because it's important to understand the principle of life itself. Obviously, if we look for happiness in the wrong place, we're not going to find it. But what is the subtle danger of looking in the wrong place and not finding happiness repeatedly? I've been in the public practice of Christian Science for over 25 years, and a practitioner is one who's available to help people with problems, whether they're physical or human relations, whether they're job-related, any kind of the problems that cause the hurts in our lives, physical and otherwise. A practitioner is available to find healing through prayer. And many times I've had someone sit in my office who has again found that thing that they thought was going to bring happiness, find that it fell short again, and they start drawing conclusions. I've heard people say things like, maybe it's not in the cards for me to ever be happy. Maybe I'm jinxed. Maybe God doesn't want me to be happy. That certainly shows a misunderstanding of the nature of God. Even maybe I'm not worthy of being happiness, of having happiness. And drawing those conclusions is erroneous. And if we unwittingly accept those conclusions, we'll find our experience continuing to repeat itself until maybe we're convinced that happiness is never meant to be for us. But let me illustrate why this is erroneous reasoning. Suppose while I was talking with you, my earring fell off, and I assumed it fell over here. And I went right on with my lecture because I didn't want to interrupt my train of thought. Actually, it had fallen and rolled over here. And when it was all the lectures over and I asked these nice people, will you help me find my earring, and we look and it's not there? If I were to stand up and say, maybe I'm jinxed, maybe it's not in the cards for me to have that earring, maybe God doesn't want me to have that earring, maybe I'm not worthy, these nice people would be standing up and saying, Mrs. Cook, don't be silly. Here's your earring. You were looking in the wrong place. Let's not draw any conclusions about ourselves or our life purpose or our life possibilities just because we haven't found happiness yet. Maybe we just need to re-examine the right place to look. There's a whole chapter in this foundational writing, Science and Health, on marriage. It's only 17 pages, but it's one of the most helpful discussions that I've ever read. It's very interesting. I'll give you a little background. I was healed of an incurable condition when I read this book for the first time. It wasn't a terminal condition. It was one that as long as I took drugs the rest of my life, I could have somewhat of a normal experience. And I was healed by reading this book, and I never took another bit of medicine from that day forward. I've never had any recurrence of the problem. I was amazed when I learned after reading the book and started thinking about the book. I couldn't help thinking about it, a book that could bring such a radical healing for me. As I started thinking about the book, I realized that it had been first written in 1875. So much of the discussion sounded now. It sounded very contemporary. And I'd like to read just a few sentences, somewhat disassociated, from this chapter to just illustrate what I'm talking about. The chapter includes, you might call, criteria for choosing a mate. It discusses the need for mutual compromises in a relationship. It discusses the challenges of raising children and of divorce, of women's rights. And let me just illustrate by just reading a few sentences. For instance, ill-arranged notes produce discord. Tones of the human mind may be different, but they should be concordant in order to blend properly. Unselfish ambition, noble life motives, and purity, these constituents of thought mingling constitute individually and collectively true happiness, strength, and permanence. Happiness is spiritual, born of truth and love. It is unselfish, therefore it cannot exist alone, but requires all mankind to share it. Our laws are not impartial, to say the least, in their discrimination as to the person, property, and parental claim of the two sexes. If the foundations of human affection are consistent with progress, they will be strong and enduring. Divorces should warn the age of some fundamental error in the marriage state. The union of the sexes suffers fearful discord. Doesn't that sound like it was written within the last two decades or so? To gain Christian Science and its harmony, that includes happiness, life should be more metaphysically regarded. Now, the word metaphysical has a very simple explanation. We're hearing it used a lot today as more and more metaphysical systems seem to be gaining attention. In Mrs. Eddy's day, it was not a word that was used a lot. But it's very simple by way of definition. Meta, a prefix, M-E-T-A, means above or beyond or outside of. So what it's really saying is that in order to gain this harmony that includes purpose and fulfillment, peace of mind, happiness, life needs to be regarded not just in the physical, but beyond that, outside of it, or in the spiritual. I remember asking the one young woman who loaned me this book if she could tell me something about Mrs. Eddy. I had wondered about a woman who could write a book and have it published in 1875 in her own name. I knew, as most artists know, that women at that day who were poets or artists or musicians, authors, often had to use a man's name in order to be accepted or published. Women were thought of as having their sphere of activity and achievement only in the home. And I remember wondering what kind of a woman could have written this book. And what I found was, is that Mrs. Eddy, from early childhood, had always had a deep interest in spiritual matters. Being the youngest of six children born in a New England home, that was deeply centered in Christian living, daily devotionals, read from the Bible. We find her drawing all through her life her deepest questions and her deepest nourishment from her Bible study. When she was in her midlife, which was mid-40s, she was healed of a critical physical problem. She was an earnest Bible scholar, and she had often pondered, as other Bible scholars have, throughout the ages, what it was that the early Christians knew that we've lost sight of, because for the first 200 or 300 years, the early Christians healed consistently through their prayers. And when she had this healing, and it came as she was praying out from a chapter in the book of Matthew, when she had her healing, she somehow felt she had touched the hem of the garment of an understanding that could bring healing through prayer. She didn't feel it was a miracle, as the attending physician felt. For the next 3 years, she withdrew from all activity and studied little else other than the Bible. And she was writing down what she was finding in a set of notes, and she was practicing what she was discovering, healing more and more consistently. A neighbor child born blind had her sight fully restored through Mrs. Eddy's prayers. People who copied her notes were healing themselves and healing others. And out of this very modest beginning, a worldwide religion was established. She called it Christian Science because, again, by definition, Christian means pertaining to the teachings of Christ Jesus. And science, in Webster's Ninth Collegiate Dictionary, has a definition that is knowledge as distinguished from ignorance or misunderstanding. So, Christian Science is simply a presentation of the knowledge, as distinguished from ignorance or misunderstanding, of the teachings of Christ Jesus. Teachings that can go deep into our lives to heal the hurts in our lives and in our bodies, to plant us on a path where we can find a harmony that includes all, that brings peace and contentment and fulfillment and purpose and accomplishment, satisfaction in our lives. Mrs. Eddy was with us till she was almost 90, and at that time she emerged as a significant presence in the religious world. At her passing, newspapers around the world had articles in tribute to her, often front page articles, and one of these papers is the Chicago Post, and the article was lengthy. I'm going to read just a small portion of it, but it gives you a feeling of how the world regarded Mrs. Eddy in 1910 at her passing. The passing of Mrs. Mary Baker Eddy brings to a close a life story that is one of the most wonderful that this country of unlimited possibilities has to show. Out of nothing that is physical, no great fortune, no industrial invention, no inherited opportunity, Mrs. Eddy built up a great career. It is the greater because its greatness was not for herself, but for the church which she founded. She took from the Bible one of the fundamental commands which modern Christianity overlooked, the solemn injunction to heal the sick. This, with an inspiration that burned steady and serene for long years, she put into a faith and a creed that has brought happiness and health and the active religious spirit to thousands upon thousands of her fellow beings. In Mrs. Eddy's later years, it's recorded that someone asked her, "What do you think of marriage?" And this is her very brief response, that it is often convenient, sometimes pleasant, and occasionally a love affair. Marriage is susceptible of many definitions. It sometimes presents the most wretched condition of human existence. To be normal, it must be a union of the affections that tends to lift mortals higher. There's not one word about happiness in that entire answer. We read that marriage, she said, is often convenient, only sometimes pleasant, and occasionally a love affair, and sometimes presenting the most wretched condition of human existence. And we ask, how can that be when a couple comes together convinced that their love is deep and abiding, convinced that they have what it takes to make that commitment in the marriage vows? What is it that can come in and either quietly erode it or abruptly smash it away? And what can we do about it? Well, I'd like to tell you about a couple that had everything going for them. Neither one of them had to work for a living. They were in this beautiful environment where everything they could ever possibly want was provided for them. And the individual who owned this place said he had to be gone for a while, and he said, while I'm away, help yourself. Enjoy. Anything here except one thing. There's only one thing, and I ask you to please leave that alone. But while some of you are catching on, who am I talking about? Adam and Eve. Exactly. You can eat of any tree in the garden of paradise where everything was exquisitely beautiful and good. But one thing you are not to eat the fruit of. And that was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, for years I thought that sentence meant the knowledge of good and the knowledge of evil. But I'd like to suggest that maybe it means a little something different. Maybe it means the knowledge of good and evil. The knowledge that there is a duality that can exist, that evil can be as powerful and as present as good. Up to that time, everything that they had known was good. In fact, in that first creation story, everything there is good. And God knew that they never needed to fall into the trap of believing in another power or another presence. They were not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But while he was gone, they ate of that fruit. And when he came back, he knew it. And there was some discussion, some accusation. I rather love how Adam, in one sentence, was able to blame everybody else on the face of the earth. Those of you who know the story, remember he said, the woman that you gave me, she made me do it. And with that, there's some discussion and there's the dismissal from the garden. And we read words like pain and sorrow and distress and travail and toil. I mentioned the three characters, Adam and Eve and God. But there was another character in this allegory. And who did I leave out? The serpent. What kind of a serpent? A talking serpent. What was the role of the serpent in this story? To tempt. The tempter, the seducer, the persuader. And it was his temptation. It's really interesting. This is recorded in the second and third chapters of Genesis. And to go back and read that little temptation rhetoric there. Because, oh, it sounds so much like a lot of the advertising that we see today. It's the temptation or the seduction, the promise that if we turn away from the teaching, the spiritual values, from the recognition of God as supreme in our lives, if we turn away from that, if we're willing to be disobedient, we can have all kinds of happiness. And success and popularity and more beauty and more prestige, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The whole seduction story is right there, and it's in terms we can understand today. We never see this talking serpent anywhere again in the Bible. But over and over and over, we see the tempter. In Jesus' wilderness experience, we see him being tempted. The Bible says he was alone and the devil came. The tempter is called the devil or Satan or the evil one, the prince of this world, the liar, the father of the lie. Those are all terms for the same thing, the tempter. Well, if we look at Jesus' teachings, his entire teaching, we see that he knew another creation story. There's the one widely known Adam and Eve creation story, but in that first chapter of Genesis, there's another creation story. Lesser known, man is not a material being made from a rib and woman subordinate made from Adam made from the dust and woman subordinate from a rib. But in this first Genesis creation story, male and female are made in the image and likeness of God, spirit. It's a spiritual being. And Jesus understood that. You see all through his teachings how he identified himself and man as this spiritual being. And it was this that enabled him to withstand the tempter. This understood. And I'd like to share an example of how this works in our experience today. This is a fun story. My husband and I love to tell it. It happened within the first year that we were married. We were living in mid-Ohio at the time. And we had driven to the East Coast to attend several day session of church meeting. And they had been wonderfully inspiring. We just felt so buoyant as we were driving home. And you know how when more than one person attends the same meeting, you tend to remember different things. And as we were driving that morning, he was telling some of the highlights that seemed special to him. And I was sharing things I remembered that seemed special to me. And it was a wonderful morning. But about noontime in the car, the whole conversation seemed to take on a different tone. And soon our voices were sharp, and then they were angry, and then they were loud. And pretty soon I felt I couldn't bear to be in the car with him for another moment. And I said to him, I know, I felt he was so dictatorial. I felt he was so demanding. I thought it was a side of him I'd never seen before. And he told me later he thought he saw a side of me he had never seen before. He thought I was so unteachable. Well, I finally found it so unbearable that I just kind of blurted out, just drive to the next town. We were in mid-New York State. And I said, drive to the next town, and I'm going to take a bus the rest of the way home. And at the very same moment, he said, I'm going to drive to the next town, and you can take a bus the rest of the way home. Talk to each other like that. And when I found us both saying the very same words at the very same time, it was like that light went on, and I remember thinking to myself, who's writing this script anyway? He must have been sensing some of the same, because he pulled over on the shoulder, and he turned off the ignition, and he reached over, and he put his hand over mine, and he was looking out his window, and I knew he was praying. And I was praying too. We had been all caught up in all of the selves that are in that Adam and Eve presentation of man. The self-importance, the self-righteousness, the self-justification, and the garment inside out, the self-pity, or that feeling of inadequacy. We were all caught up in that, and we were turning on each other, and we felt we hadn't been able to bear each other. But when we were praying quietly and we were no longer turning on each other, we started turning on the tempter. There was no man in a red suit in that car. There was no talking serpent. But the tempter was there, trying to get us all involved in who is right, instead of turning with humility to God with that honest prayer of what is right. Well, after we prayed a while, we started talking in that calmer, gentler way. And we soon had things resolved, and we had a very happy trip the rest of the way home. Would you like to know what we were quarreling about? How to build a free road map. I suspect there's a map or two story here. It was time to get off for lunch. And I had taken the map out, and we had agreed on where to get off, and I folded it up, and he said, you folded it wrong. And I had put it back in the glove compartment. I said, it's all right. And he said, take it out and fold it right. And I said, why? And he said, it'll wear out faster if you do it wrong. And I said, who cares? It's free. Hardly worth splitting about. But that's the way the tempter works. As we continued, we had our lunch, and as we continued our driving, we promised each other that if that awful edge starts creeping into our discussion, if we start feeling full of self-righteousness or self-pity, any of those self-families that have nothing to do with the God-centered man that's in the first chapter of Genesis, that spiritually minded man, that when we would start feeling like we wanted to turn on each other, that we would agree that the first one who saw it would just gently touch the other one's shoulder or arm, and then we would separate. And we would turn on the tempter instead of each other. Get thee behind me, Satan. Let me hear what God is telling me. I can't tell you how helpful that's been. We've used it over and over. I think the very first time was a few months later when we were wallpapering. There have been times we've only had to turn our heads away from each other for a few minutes, and then we could come back with a different approach to the discussion. Sometimes we've had to leave the room. There have been a couple of times in our life where we actually had to kind of mentally separate for a period of several weeks while each of us in our most earnest prayer turned to our Father, Mother God, turning on the tempter, knowing that he doesn't make me happy, she doesn't make me happy, God makes me happy, and God makes him / her happy, and together we can find that basis for that harmony that includes happiness, purpose, fulfillment, peace of mind, and so forth. I can't tell you how helpful it's been in raising 5 children. How many times, instead of turning on the child, I've turned on the tempter, and I've found some distance there, and then when we came back together, because I no longer was filled with either the accusation towards the child or the terrible feelings of not being a good mother, you know, that we all always have to deal with, being free from all that because we turned on the tempter and turned to God as the one divine parent, we could come back together and find the communication opened and find the compromise or just the acceptance of the household rules there, because it wasn't one person trying to dominate another or rule another. How very, very helpful this has been. Well, if we look at Jesus' teachings, his entire teaching, we see that he knew another creation story. There's the one widely known Adam and Eve creation story, but in that first chapter of Genesis, there's another creation story. Lesser known, man is not a material being made from a rib and woman subordinate, Adam made from the dust and woman subordinate from a rib. But in this first Genesis creation story, male and female are made in the image and likeness of God, spirit. It's a spiritual being. And Jesus understood that. You see all through his teachings how he identified himself and man as this spiritual being. And it was this that enabled him to withstand the tempter. This understood. And I'd like to share an example of how this works in our experience today. This is a fun story. My husband and I love to tell it. It happened within the first year that we were married. We were living in mid-Ohio at the time. And we had driven to the East Coast to attend a several-day session of church meetings. And they had been wonderfully inspiring. We just felt so buoyant as we were driving home. And you know how when more than one person attends the same meeting, you tend to remember different things. And as we were driving that morning, he was telling some of the highlights that seemed special to him. And I was sharing things I remembered that seemed special to me. And it was a wonderful morning. But about noontime in the car, the whole conversation seemed to take on a different tone. And soon our voices were sharp, and then they were angry, and then they were loud. And pretty soon I felt I couldn't bear to be in the car with him for another moment. And I said to him, I know, I felt he was so dictatorial. I felt he was so demanding. I thought it was a side of him I'd never seen before. And he told me later he thought he saw a side of me he had never seen before. He thought I was so unteachable. Well, I finally found it so unbearable that I just kind of blurted out, just drive to the next town. We were in mid-New York State. And I said, drive to the next town, and I'm going to take a bus the rest of the way home. And at the very same moment, he said, I'm going to drive to the next town, and you can take a bus the rest of the way home. Talk to each other like that. And when I found us both saying the very same words at the very same time, it was like that light went on, and I remember thinking to myself, who's writing this script anyway? He must have been sensing some of the same, because he pulled over on the shoulder, and he turned off the ignition, and he reached over, and he put his hand over mine, and he was looking out his window, and I knew he was praying. And I was praying too. We had been all caught up in all of the selves that are in that Adam and Eve presentation of man. The self-importance, the self-righteousness, the self-justification, and the garment inside out, the self-pity, or that feeling of inadequacy. We were all caught up in that, and we were turning on each other, and we felt we hadn't been able to bear each other. But when we were praying quietly, and we were no longer turning on each other, we started turning on the tempter. There was no man in a red suit in that car. There was no talking serpent, but the tempter was there, trying to get us all involved in who is right, instead of turning with humility to God with that honest prayer of what is right. Well, after we prayed a while, we started talking in that calmer, gentler way, and we soon had things resolved, and we had a very happy trip the rest of the way home. Would you like to know what we were quarreling about? How to build a free road map. Suspect there's a map or two story here. It was time to get off for lunch. And I had taken the map out, and we had agreed on where to get off, and I folded it up, and he said, "You folded it wrong." And I had put it back in the glove compartment. I said, "It's all right." And he said, "Take it out and fold it right." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "It'll wear out faster if you do it wrong." And I said, "Who cares? It's free." Hardly worth splitting about. But that's the way the tempter works. As we continued, we had our lunch, and as we continued our driving, we promised each other that if that awful edge starts creeping into our discussion, if we start feeling full of self-righteousness or self-pity, any of those self-families that have nothing to do with the God-centered man that's in the first chapter of Genesis, that spiritually minded man, that when we would start feeling like we wanted to turn on each other, that we would agree that the first one who saw it would just gently touch the other one's shoulder or arm, and then we would separate. And we would turn on the tempter instead of each other. "Get thee behind me, Satan. Let me hear what God is telling me." I can't tell you how helpful that's been. We've used it over and over. I think the very first time was a few months later when we were wallpapering. There have been times we've only had to turn our heads away from each other for a few minutes, and then we could come back with a different approach to the discussion. Sometimes we've had to leave the room. There have been a couple of times in our life where we actually had to kind of mentally separate for a period of several weeks, while each of us in our most earnest prayer turned to our Father, Mother God, turning on the tempter, knowing that he doesn't make me happy, she doesn't make me happy, God makes me happy, and God makes him / her happy, and together we can find that basis for that harmony that includes happiness, purpose, fulfillment, peace of mind, and so forth. I can't tell you how helpful it's been in raising 5 children. How many times, instead of turning on the child, I've turned on the tempter, and I've found some distance there, and then when we came back together, because I no longer was filled with either the accusation towards the child or the terrible feelings of not being a good mother, you know, that we all always have to deal with, being free from all that because we turned on the tempter and turned to God as the one divine parent, we could come back together and find the communication opened, and find the compromise, or just the acceptance of the household rules there, because it wasn't one person trying to dominate another or rule another. How very, very helpful this has been. It's been helpful in business. Someone can say, "Well, that's fine. That was a road map. That's rather trivial." What do you do when it's not trivial? Well, I've chosen a business experience because I'd like to show how this crosses into all areas of our activity. I was asked to prepare for a very important meeting, one that depended primarily upon me for its execution. And I had been given a very small staff and not much time to do this in. And we worked hard. I had worked with these people before. They were dependable, and I had done delegating. And the night before the meeting was to take place, we came together quite late, and everyone was to put their pieces on the table, and we were to bring it all together. And one very important piece that I had delegated to a young man on my staff, when I asked for it, he just dropped his hands, and he looked at me, and he said, "I didn't do it." Unacceptable. Always the rule in the office is if you can't do it, it comes back across the desk. We get more people on it, or I pitch in. But never was it acceptable to just simply not do it. And it was not done, and there was no way humanly possible that I could get it done. There are no words to describe to you the sense of betrayal and abandonment that I felt at that time. I'm not a violent person, but I really wanted to walk over to him and just kind of beat on his chest. It just seemed so unacceptable. Now, years before, I had read that wonderful little gem of wisdom in Proverbs, "A soft answer turneth away wrath." You know, for a long time, I thought that meant that if you speak soft enough, the other guy won't get as mad. But somewhere along the line, I had learned that what it really means is that when one is in control of their voice, of their body, of their thinking, the temptation for wrath or anger to reach that one becomes ineffective. And I knew I had to be in control of my voice and my hands. I kept my voice soft and my hands loose, and I said to my staff, "I've got to go into my office for a few minutes." They all knew I prayed and had the Bible and science and health in my office, and I went in and closed the door. But on the way in, just as I got to the door, I turned back, and I just had to say one kind of sarcastic thing to this staff member, and I said, "You sure hit below the belt this time." I'd never said that to anybody in my life. And I went into the office, and I was praying. I walked that floor back and forth, really reaching out to God for the wisdom, the intelligence, the control, the ability to meet with what looked like was going to be a very big hole in this very important meeting. There's a wonderful short sentence in this book that even the Sunday school children learn very early on. In reference to God, it says, "Divine love always has met and always will meet every human need." And I had a human need, and I was pacing the floor just reaching out for that divine love to show me the wisdom as to how to meet this human need. And I was finding some sense of composure and calm coming as I just reached out so wholeheartedly, but I kept hearing that funny little thing ringing in my ears. "You sure hit below the belt." And I thought, why did I say that? And then as I continued thinking about it, I remembered way back in my high school years, I dated a Golden Gloves boxer. I did not like boxing, but I liked him. And so I went to the boxing matches. And one of the things I learned was that it's a foul to hit below the belt, because that's considered a vulnerable place. And I thought, vulnerable? Where am I vulnerable in this? And then I heard it, and you heard me say it. A meeting that depended primarily upon me for its success? That's not Christ Jesus' pattern. This isn't what our way shower showed us, who over and over said, "I of mine own self can do nothing. If the Father that worketh in me, why callest thou me good?" His pattern for success was always that God was the doer, the beer. And his activity said, "As the Father speaks, I speak." Always it came out of that inseparable relationship to his Father, Mother, God. And I'd lost sight of that. And as I saw that, I turned for the first time, instead of wanting to turn on my staff member or turn on myself, I turned on the tempter. And as I walked the floor, I said, "You almost had me. You almost had me believing that I was something apart from God. But right now, I have learned this lesson. And I will try to remember this lesson for the rest of my life. It is the Father that worketh hitherto, and I work also." And I turned to the tempter and I said, "Get thee behind me with your suggestions of ego. There's that self-centeredness. And, you know, then you have the flip side always, the feeling that I was going to be totally inadequate, and I said, I of my own self can do nothing. I don't know how this meeting will go, but the lesson that I have learned here tonight is more important than any meeting in the whole world. And I found my spiritual poise as I summarily dismissed the tempter, thinking there will be no self-centered thinking, good or bad, in this whole experience. And we put everything together. Still didn't know how it was going to all work out, but we went home. The next day went incredibly well. There was so much material. It was so pressed down and running over that there wouldn't have been room for that piece if it had been there. And when the evaluations came back, the people who attended felt it was one of the best meetings of its kind that they had ever attended. And I wasn't fooled then into taking any credit for it. I had learned, and I had learned a wonderful lesson regarding the tempter. Paul saw this whole business of the tempter, I think, in a very clear way when he wrote in the 7th and 8th chapter of Romans, and we so identify with Paul. Christians everywhere do, because Paul's the one who wrote, "The good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do." He was wrestling. How many of us have felt that we wish we could take back something we said or did that hurt someone, or we wished we had written that note or made that call and we didn't? And Paul knew. But he knew what he was dealing with, because a few verses further down he said, "I see another law in my members warring against the law of my mind." He saw the tempter as suggestion in thought. No talking serpent, no man personifying devil or evil, but as the wicked, devilish, self-centered kind of thinking. That carnal-minded thinking that Paul said must be put off, and that spiritually God-centered thinking that he said must be put on. And he says there's no condemnation if we don't do what we should do. He said, "Therefore now there is no condemnation to them which are in Christ Jesus, who walk not after the flesh," after that second creation man, "but after the Spirit. For they that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh, but they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded, self-centered in our thinking, fleshly, material, to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace and happiness and fulfillment and purpose and peace of mind." When I first gave this lecture, I didn't have this next little part, but a very interesting thing happened when I had given it 13 or 14 times. I was up in New England, and after the lecture, a beautiful little silver-haired lady with the most radiant countenance came up to me, and she said, "I had the most perfect marriage." She said, "It lasted, I don't know, 40-some years." And she said, "There were no two people ever happier than we were." And I was about to reach out and give her a hug and say, "Oh, good for you." Because you could see the happiness written on her face, and then all of a sudden her face crumbled. And she said, "But he's gone. He's been gone for 6 years. And she said, "Every night when I go to bed, I pray I won't wake up the next day." Because all of that good marriage, life without him was a hole. A hole that the tempter had convinced her nothing could fill. And she had never known to turn on the tempter. And often there are holes in our lives, seemingly. A good friend, a child, a parent has moved away. Or there's been a divorce, or there's been a death. Or the job we were promised didn't come through, or the promotion. Maybe a good friend has misunderstood and has pulled away, and there seems to be a hole. And we need to turn on the tempter, who will tell us that happiness depends upon a person or a place or a thing, and that happiness, because of that, can be taken from us, and would keep us looking backwards instead of looking Godward, knowing that it's in this relationship with the Father and the understanding of God as the very principle of our life itself that brings us the harmony, restores the harmony. And if we can look forward, Godward, we can find that hole filling, not discrediting one iota from the good that was there, but not feeling that good is so personal that it can never, ever be there again. So important that we heal the hurts in our lives so that we prevent the hurts in our bodies.
We are sorry that this lecture has ended prematurely. We hope you have enjoyed it.